Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
A lot of people who watch my channel have reached out and told me that my videos in some way helped them not to fall into the far right kind of pipeline, because often they'll say like, oh, I was watching all these Ben Shapiro videos and I was really annoyed at feminists and like, but like your videos I didn't feel judged by, and like it opened my eyes and gave me this perspective that sort of took some of the appeal out of Ben Shapiro. That's really, that to me feels good. Taking the appeal out of Ben Shapiro, that's good. If I did that for one person, that's a day's work.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. I've found recently myself frustrated and increasingly disquieted or just with unease about like the state of the discourse, capital D. Now that's sort of permanently true. If you spend all your day on the internet and on social media and like arguing with people and reading stuff and reading people who are arguing with other people, you're constantly in this kind of weird vortex of verbal battle and conflict that's probably like completely unnatural. It's definitely completely unnatural. There's something kind of, you know, satisfying about it, just because I like intellectual stimulation and because I like argumentation and I like debate and I like public issues and I like examining things and I like back and forth and I like learning new things, which is why I, you know, do what I do for a living. But there's a thing that's happened where I think that the technologies that we've been using to have our conversations have this kind of like flattening effect where everything gets sledgehammered down into these kind of slogans. And I find that, you know, even the case recently, I find myself like with people I agree with or views I agree with being communicated in these kind of like very short, pithy slogans that I get why they exist and they might be effective for getting a message out, but there also seems increasingly this kind of invitation for people not to think. Like the way that social media functions is just to sloganeer or to pass on these memes, and like examination or questioning or fighting or arguing about it or being curious about it. Or I was thinking about this because I saw this meme that was going around during the violence between the rockets being fired by Hamas and the Israeli bombardment of Gaza, which I found to be really awful and incredibly upsetting. And 60 plus children were killed in that. Two Israeli children were killed. There were deaths on both sides, but massively, massively more on the Gazan side. And there was this meme that was just like, the sort of point of the meme was like, said something like, it's not complicated. And I got what the meme was trying to communicate. What the meme was trying to communicate was like, there is a moral simplicity to this that you shouldn't allow people to spin you away from. And I get that. And I think that was actually probably an effective thing. But I also had this feeling of like, well, it's kind of complicated. Like, honestly, everything in life is pretty complicated. And just like the it's not complicated to me felt like this expression of an impulse and an ethos in social media discourse that I find myself increasingly just discomforted by, because I think like learning things and asking questions and wrestling with hard questions can sit alongside moral clarity and clear principles. Like those two things don't have to be distinct. You can have clear views and clear principles and understand that some things are truly morally simple but factually complex, and want to ask questions about the factually complex aspects and maybe be open to the possibility of them being more morally complex than you thought going in. All this to say that the way that our discourse functions and the way that algorithms function, I think particularly to produce the discourse we have, can be really flattening. And a great counter to that is today's guest, Natalie Nguyen, who goes by ContraPoints on the internets. She's a YouTuber who has a fascinating backstory as a philosophy grad student who basically started to get into YouTube and found herself kind of found the algorithm to be pushing her in directions that she thought were really weird. I will get into her whole kind of life story. But what I really, really like about Natalie's work is she is staking this claim. She's massively popular, millions and millions and millions of views, but she's trying to stake out this ground on the internet that is both morally clear and rigorous and also sophisticated and nuanced and curious and doesn't take herself too seriously and produces these fascinating videos that are kind of genre-defying in their aesthetics. You should definitely check them out. We will definitely link to them. But I thought, like, to talk about, like, the state of the discourse or why our arguments sound like they do, the best person to talk to was Natalie Wynn. So thank you for coming on Why Is This Happening?
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for that intro.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the best way to intro you for someone that is completely unfamiliar with your work.
I think you did a good job. I usually try to avoid explaining what my channel is about if it comes up in conversation. People are like, oh, you have a YouTube channel. What's it about? I'm like, oh, the internet. I'm evasive because I don't want to say that, oh, I'm a leftist trans woman who talks about, you know, how the internet became fascist in 2017 and the consequences of that. Like, I don't want to have that conversation with an Uber driver. It's more than I can bear.
Well, that was a good one. A leftist trans woman who talks about how the internet essentially facilitated fascism in 2017 is actually, maybe that's a better button slogan for what I should have done as your intro.
No, I liked your intro. I thought it was new. I'm tired of the old intro about the fascism. I'm done with. I'm ready to move on from fascism.
Well, I don't think fascism is ready to move on from us.
Yeah, fascism is never ready to move on from us. So we'll keep an eye on it. But I think it's good to talk about other things from time to time instead of letting your entire life be run by these maniacs.
Well, we're going to talk about the sort of darkness of the fascist and proto-fascist and maybe like fascist sympathetic corners of the internet that you have explored in your work. But I wanted to start with telling me you were a philosophy student, right?
That's right. As an undergraduate, I mean, I kind of went through a few things first. I was a music major, but ended up getting a, you know, double majoring in philosophy and psychology. And then I went to grad school. I was a PhD student in the philosophy department at Northwestern, where I made it 2 years, enough to get a master's degree, and realized, like, academia is not for me. Nope. I dropped out. So that's my background. But I would say that I have the instincts of an entertainer. I can remember going to an undergraduate philosophy conference and reading a paper to a full room. And at one point, some line in my philosophy paper got a laugh. And I was just like, this is what I live for. Like, this is what I want. And I was like, oh, I'm in the wrong career. Interesting. Yeah.
By the way, I completely know that feeling and 100% feel the same way about that. Like,
intoxicating.
Oh my God. We did back in the before times, but we were doing these live with pod shows. We were the live podcast. Mm. And, you know, if you come on a stage and there's like 1,000 people in a room or 1,500 people in a room and you say something, they all laugh. That's really tough to beat.
Yeah, that'll sustain you through the next week. I'm actually a very shy person offline. So I think that YouTube is actually kind of the perfect stage for me because it caters to the exact contradiction of like attention starved and introversion that I think a lot of us kind of who thrive on the internet kind of have this combination of personality flaws.
So you decided that philosophy is not for you, but what did you like about philosophy or what has sort of drawn you to it?
Well, I really liked being a philosophy major when I was an undergraduate. I think philosophy is more fun to study at the kind of 101, 201, maybe even 301 level. It's fun to get this like grand tour of intellectual history, and you're reading Plato 1 week and the feminist philosophers the next week and then postmodernism. And it's like, it's very exciting to go through all of this for the first time, and you feel the kind of thrill of your mind expanding. But by the time that you're considering writing a dissertation and it's like, okay, which three paragraphs of Heidegger am I going to spend the rest of my 20s writing about?
Totally.
Oh, that's a different situation. And I wasn't, I don't have the patience for that, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's exactly how I had flirted with the idea of philosophy grad school and kind of had the same feeling. I was also drawn to performance and theater. But yes, when things start to get super specialized and super recondite and super like specific, it gets less fun than the
lose interest.
Yeah,
because it stops being about things. It becomes harder to make it about life.
Yes.
And I think that is something that's kind of a downer for me in academic philosophy and kind of in the humanities in general. Like, obviously there is incredible scholarship that still goes on in the humanities. I don't want to completely bash it, but I do find that a lot of people, like once they really get up there to the higher echelons of academia, like the stuff they're talking about is like, oh, it's so abstract and so detached from any actual problem that needs solving that it's hard for me to sustain interest. Yeah, for sure.
So how did you first start like both watching YouTube videos and then deciding you wanted to make them?
Well, I am a millennial. I was born in 1988. So YouTube was invented in 2005. I was, so how old, 17, something like that. And I've been watching YouTube since the beginning. I think the first time I ever uploaded a video myself was in 2007. And it was a video of me playing the piano. So that's, you know, I started out in a very amateurish way, just uploading like little piano videos, later vlogs. I guess my first like real sense that YouTube could be a place where discourse happens. Like it could be an actual public forum. It could be a place where people are getting news, or getting information, where conversations are happening is there was this phenomenon in 2008, 2009, what later became called YouTube skepticism or the YouTube skeptic community that was kind of like, it was almost like kind of a fan community that started with like the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens. I don't know why this was the one topic that took off on YouTube, but there was a real community around it. There were meetups, there were debates. People were making a kind of, you know, primeval, what we now call a video essay about, you know, why creationism is wrong. And, you know, here's my argument against, you know, Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God and this kind of thing. And this was interesting to me when I was 19 years old. I guess by the time I was 22, I had kind of decided this was cringe. And in retrospect, I guess a lot of the new atheist stuff had some, it kind of had the seeds of some very toxic things that later sort of became alt-right YouTube or maybe alt-light YouTube, we could say, that this fixation on the unique like barbarism of Islam, for example, I think, was something that I look back on and I'm like, oh God, like you can see the ugliness. There was also the fact that this is a kind of, I knew a lot of women in this community. The gender balance was, I mean, there were a lot of women involved, but much like gaming around the same time, the community was fairly misogynistic. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being the issue that tore the community apart was the question of feminism. A lot of, you know, kind of men in STEM who had STEM degrees in that, I'm not trying to bash an entire family of fields. I'm just saying like culturally, well, let's just say that the idea of some women coming forward as feminists was so threatening to them that it tore the community apart.
My understanding is that part of your desire and decision to make your own videos was in a kind of dialogue with this part of the internet, and you've continued it up. Like, what is it about a certain kind of youngish man on the internet and the subcultures they create that become so, I don't know, toxic, authoritarian, fascist, sympathetic? Like, what is that dynamic?
Well, I think a lot of young men in the last couple of decades feel very threatened by the advancement of, you know, in particular, people who are not white men. And I think, you know, the reason for that is culturally, I think this is still a generation of men that was kind of raised to think that the world was theirs. Mm. Obviously, it's more complicated than just that. But I think in subtle ways, there's a sense of entitlement that is cultivated in the upbringing of a lot of boys, especially white boys. And so the very real gains of women, for example, I think, you know, to the point where it's like, you know, women are now the majority in a lot of universities.
Yep.
It's kind of threatening. It makes boys insecure, young men insecure about what their place in the world is exactly. I think there's a kind of crisis of masculinity where men aren't sure how to be men in the 21st century. What is it that they're supposed to do now? They're being told that it's toxic to engage in sort of some of the traditional expressions of masculinity, sexual aggression, Don Juanism, aggression against other men, that, you know. And so there's this anxiety that is pretty legible to me, and things like, oh, this like soy boys and cucks and like all this vocabulary that we got in 2015 was an expression of this sort of, I don't know, identity crisis, quarter life identity crisis of a lot of men.
Yeah. And I think that that crisis and the way that it feeds itself online, I mean, a lot of those instincts and cultural pathologies feel both very distinct to the moment, but also, you know, across time. I think, like, you know, I've said this before in the program.
Yeah,
but like,
it's not.
Yeah, like a bunch of young men together, like hopped up in any in any setting.
It's been known to cause trouble. Yes.
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. In any setting, like, you know, I think about this in violence all the time when you look at both historical but also like cross-country violence studies, right? Like men between 16 and 30 are, you know, doing the bulk of the violence basically everywhere.
It's not some special thing about American culture. No, it's a combination of high testosterone levels and too much time on one's hands.
Right, but I also wonder like how much the algorithms facilitate it, which gets to this kind of medium question. Right? I can never, you know, and I go back and forth on this as someone who spends a lot of time on the internet, like how much of it is just the way things are and how much of it is the way that the algorithms are functioning or the way the platforms or what they're incentivizing. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that the way people talk about the algorithm is so vague. I think, you know, one issue here is that it's for the most part very opaque. There's a few things we know, like we know that in 2012, the algorithm began to consider watch time over raw clicks. Hmm. And that clearly played a role in the kind of success of video essays as a genre, where suddenly, you know, it was never in your interest before to, I mean, I've been on YouTube long enough that I remember when the advice to aspiring creators was keep it under 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, no one's going to watch a video that's so long as 10 minutes. That started changing though, I think as a result of the algorithm. It actually, I think, made sort of long form political video is a much more viable thing on the medium. A lot of attention on the media has been given to what was termed the alt-right pipeline, where people watching gamers on YouTube would eventually be recommended gaming commentators. The gaming commentators were also talking about politics. You know, sort of Gamergate is an event that is, I think, correctly seen as sort of pivotal, where gamer as an identity was sort of politicized as a kind of like, you know, millennial male identity politics almost. And
in a very reactionary fashion, right?
Very like, reactionary. Yeah. Absolutely. Because it's backlash politics against feminism, against women, against people of color, against LGBT people. And so this moment kind of launched the careers of people who became infamous in the following years, Milo Yiannopoulos being the most prominent one. That was all a result of kind of, you know, the increasing reactionary sort of thread in gaming culture on YouTube. And I think that, you know, we talk about the algorithm like we're talking about some kind of Sumerian god that's, you know, motivations are mysterious and possibly sinister. But yeah, I think it's just a simple, you know, the fact that like I said, you know, popular gaming content kind of funneled people into commentary. A lot of that commentary was reactionary, and it sort of became a snowball effect where you had increasing radicalism. You know, people found that, oh, this was, people who had far right beliefs found that this was actually a pretty good area to do recruitment, and more people started doing that.
How would you compare the sort of vibrancy of that alt-right, this sort of nexus of sort of young male interests, gaming content, reactionary resistance to, you know, what's viewed as political correctness? That I'm dating myself now, wokeness. I put in quotes because like it's such an annoying.
It's exactly the same concept. Yeah.
It's literally the same thing. Yes.
Yeah.
Like, what is the status of that in 2021 as opposed to 2015?
Well, I think in 2015, there was this really intense sense of being embattled and aggrieved. I mean, there still is that, of course, but I think it was actually more intense in 2015 when, you know, we had had 8 years of Obama. It seemed like Hillary was likely to be president next. So I think Trump changed some things. I think that Well, there's part of me that's kind of hoping that this nightmarish 4 years will sort of inoculate this country and inoculate the internet against some of this far-right populist stuff, but maybe that's too optimistic.
Talk about your form, because you made mention of it now, and what I really like about what you do is they're like these long, very well-produced, sort of fascinatingly produced visual essays that are like 30 minutes long. Do people watch them?
People certainly do. And my videos keep getting longer. The last one I did was, I think, 90 minutes. And it's gotten watched as much as anything. It has 3 million views in a few months. So people are watching very long form content. The increasing length of the videos is something that's, you know, I think it's a combination of things. One is, you know, as I get more experienced, I'm sort of better able to execute a really ambitious project like that. I know how to pace it so that it doesn't get boring. I think, as I said, the algorithm now kind of encourages stuff where people are watching for a long time. People are used to, I mean, people listen to hour-long podcasts, of course. People will
you know, people listening right now. Yeah. So don't turn us off.
Of course. And I know some people will watch a, you know, political or sort of commentary YouTube video. They'll kind of use it as a podcast. I mean, my videos are so visual, I like to think that people are just watching and starry-eyed the whole time. I think the reality is, though, people are doing their laundry, and that's fine. I mean, that's how I watch YouTube. You know, I'm making dinner or whatever, and I'll put a video on. So I think this is a good development, quite honestly, because people read less, which is a little bit concerning, because you worry that, I mean, there's always a panic going on about how media is going to destroy the minds of the young, right?
Right.
I think that's overblown, but I think, you know, people are willing to listen to 90 minutes to 2 hours, you know, what may as well be a lecture or reading an essay. It's just that it's done in a video, audio video form on YouTube. And so I think that probably this is a medium that's only going to be taken more seriously as time goes on.
I want to talk to you about what you're trying to do in these sort of conversations, what your approach is, and trying to kind of talk to people where they are and bring them in and persuade them right after we take this quick break.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try MSNBC. Understand more.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Natalie, for people that are not familiar with your work, can you just sort of give an example of like what a topic would be and what your sort of goal is and what the visual essay is trying to do, who you're trying to talk to?
So my most popular video I've ever done was one I did about 3 years ago called Incels. And it's about, I assume most people know what incels are at this point. It's about this community of men who feel that they, because of whatever unfortunate genetic defects, simply are unable to find a girlfriend. And it becomes this kind of spiral of self-defeating doom, right? It's not only, oh, I'm unlovable. It's also, I'll never be happy. And then that pretty much quickly turns to, and it's feminism's fault, and it's the fault of, you know, so a person in pain always wants someone to blame, right? So that starts, and you know, at this point, the incel movement has inspired so many mass murderers. There's an entire timeline on Wikipedia devoted to charting them. So
it's really, really grisly.
It's extremely, grisly. And so I kind of became fascinated by this community because of the violence that it was producing. And so I made a video. I wanted it to serve two functions. One is that it's supposed to educate a general audience about what this group of people is. Why are they like this? And what are they like? Is there anything we can do about it? And then the other is I'm aware that people who are, if not like obsessive members of these incel forums, people who are kind of at risk for falling into this way of thinking. I want those people to watch, and I want to try to make content in a way so that someone who's kind of not with me from the beginning might actually listen to at least a little bit of what I have to say. So I try to be very inviting in my videos. No one likes to be lectured. No one likes a sermon, right? So I try to, that's the tone that I always try to avoid having. I want to produce content in a way that is a little more seductive than that, you know? It's not hectoring and doesn't make you feel like you're being judged. And that also just kind of naturally suits my personality. I think that some people think that I'm, you know, I actually am a moral fanatic at heart, and I'm just adopting this sort of ironic persona as some kind of strategy. No, I think that it just suits my personality. I think for me, I feel a little bit at an arm's length from morality. I'm just kind of more of an aesthetic person than a moral person, and that's not a popular personality type on the far left. But
no,
I think
it's a nice sublimated Kierkegaard either or reference there.
Yeah, that's exactly where I got that from. Yeah.
<I know. laughs> No, I think you're right. And I think there's something interesting, which is that I actually think that the valence of both moral relativism versus moral absolutism and moral certainty versus like aesthetic investment, the valence of that has kind of switched a little bit in my lifetime. 20 years ago, I would say that like moral relativism was a little bit of the domain of the left and moral absolutism was kind of the puritanical right. And I think there's been a little bit of an inversion between those two.
Yes.
I think the right wing has gotten increasingly morally relativistic, even like nihilistic, and the left has gotten more moral absolutist. And in good, like I'm not saying that in a judgmental way, just observing that. And I think it actually is that transposition accounts for some of the weirdness in our politics at this moment.
Oh, I completely agree with that analysis. And it's kind of fascinating to have watched this. But yeah, I remember being in high school, this was the early 2000s. And even back then, like I understood myself as a progressive. Like what that meant was much more of this, like, I don't know, kind of like free love, like, you know, anti-censorship, like kind of almost like looking back to the 60s idea of what leftism was, whereas it has become this more like Soviet atmosphere of moral fanaticism in the meantime. Well, you can probably glean from the way that I'm describing this. I don't love the development, but I also think that, you know, there are good things about it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I wrestle with is that like moral fanaticism has its place, you know, like as someone who spends a lot of time reading history of the run up to the Civil War and the aftermath, you know, the abolitionists were constantly being called moral fanaticists and they absolutely were moral fanaticists.
Yeah. Well, John Brown, right? Like that guy at the time would have been considered a maniac, but in retrospect, it looks like he's the only rational one there.
Right. Yeah. And that becomes a tricky part, which is like, what to be morally clear about and what not to be, which I think it ends up being the kind of distinction that we all make informally and then becomes the kind of battleground for a lot of the fights we're having.
Yeah, I think that's right. You have to choose moments where you're going to be a moral fanatic in your own time, right? You choose moments where you're like, oh, I'm putting my foot down on this. But yeah, you have to choose those moments selectively because it's actually kind of a destructive thing to be like really committed. I mean, it sort of has to be, right? If you're going to change the world, that doesn't happen without, you know, disorder and disruption.
What is your, if it's okay with you, I want to just ask some personal questions just about what your life is like, because you're such a kind of like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, sort of like ethereal presence on YouTube. And partly because of like the aesthetics of your production, to me, you exist in this like digital universe, but like you're a person, you wake up, you get coffee. Like where do you live? What's your day like?
Yeah, I'm different from a lot of YouTubers. And I mean, conventionally on YouTube, authenticity is kind of the ultimate virtue. Like, people tend to watch YouTubers, especially like more traditional vloggers, because it's like, oh, you feel like you know this person. Yep. They're like, hey, what's up, you guys? Like, I'm showing you around my apartment and we're doing things today. And like, that's kind of the vibe of the video. Whereas I have created this like aestheticized alternate universe that I exist in. Well, I am a person. I guess I consider myself some kind of artist and I create these videos. But yeah, I'm not literally... I'm not an aesthetic creation. I'm just a person who eats at Subway sometimes when I'm at the airport and I'm late like everyone else. I live in Baltimore. I live alone. I've been quarantined alone for a year. It's been very horrible. I don't know. What do you want me to say? I'm a trans woman, so that comes up a lot.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get to that in a second. But also, like, okay. Do you, this is a prying question, but like, you make a living off YouTube, right? I mean, this is like, I feel like such an old man asking you this, and I apologize, but like,
go crazy.
I'm just like, well, what's the deal? Like, you, like, how's it work? And again, this is one of these things where like YouTubers and the culture around YouTubers and Instagram influencers, all these things. Like, I know about them because I read style pieces in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. I remember the like cringe inducing nature of conversations with like baby boomers back in, 2003 about bloggers, because they had like read a New York Times magazine piece about blogs. And I as like kind of a native to that universe had to like explain it in this sort of like annoying way. And now I am that person like asking you to explain to me, how does the business model work?
From a business perspective, I'll tell you exactly how it works. In my case, most of the money that I make comes from Patreon. So right. Patreon is subscription-based fan funding. People who like my videos go to my Patreon page. It's separate from YouTube. And they pledge a monthly amount in the way that people use to pledge to like support, I don't know, classical music radio stations or something like that.
Right.
And they get little rewards for that, such as their name goes in the credits of my videos. I will do, ask me anything live streams where people can ask me a question. And that's honestly the only reason why I was able to make a career out of this. Traditionally, the way YouTubers make money is through ad revenue. And that incentivizes a very different structure of video making to Patreon. Mm-hmm. If you're treating this as a business, and you want to make money with ad revenue, your job is to get as many clicks, as many eyeballs on ads by whatever means necessary, which tends to mean churning out content that, I mean, I hesitate to call it garbage, but sometimes it's garbage. Like, yeah. I don't know.
It's disposable
content that is never made to be rewatched. It doesn't particularly, need to be life-changing or loved by people. It just needs to be watched. That's the bar. Yeah. And so there's no reason really to devote more time and effort than the minimum needed to achieve that. Whereas on Patreon, the goal is to make content that people love so much that they will pay you to make it. That's a very different bar. And it incentivizes a very different kind of structure. So, I mean, I'm working on a huge project right now. It's a video that's going to be more than an hour long once again. And I've been working on it for months. That would be a disaster if I was only making money from ads. But because of Patreon, I can do this.
You know, I had that thought when I was watching your videos of like, man, this seems like a lot of work.
It's an immense amount of work. I often have no life when I'm working on these projects because of how much work it is.
Yeah, it's like lightings and costumes and cutaways. And I mean, it's like these are extremely produced things. So that makes sense. And that, that speaks to something broader to me where like I am really excited about the kind of subscription versus ad-based, which are basically the two models. I mean,
yeah.
Cable news has a hunter-gatherer hybrid, right? Which is that the mm-hmm. reason cable news is successful is it has both. So there's the subscription fees, the sub fees that come in, and then there's the advertising. And between those two, like you have two different models. And it sounds like what you're describing is kind of the same. Like there's some advertising revenue that comes in from YouTube. Most of what provides a stability or these subscribers through Patreon.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So at this point, my videos are getting, views in the millions. That's enough that it's significant ad revenue, but still most of the funding that I have comes from Patreon. You don't need to have millions of people to make it as a living.
Right.
Like I made this my full-time job when I was at a much smaller level, you know, because before this, I mean, after I dropped out of grad school, I was basically in the gig economy. I was, you know, teaching piano lessons. I was driving Uber. I was being a copywriter and that kind of gig work.
Yeah, contract work.
So that, yeah, exactly. So the second that I was able to switch to YouTube full-time, I did. And, you know, at the time, I think I only had, you know, 40,000 subscribers on YouTube and probably, I don't know, just probably a few hundred patrons, but that was enough.
How many patrons do you have now?
I have, it sort of fluctuates between 12 and 13,000.
Wow. That's
so
cool.
I mean, I'm in the top 20 on Patreon, which I'm very fortunate.
And do you, like, have you built out a business around this, or do you just do this all yourself?
I mostly do it myself. So to the point that it's actually a little bit insane, like I have a kind of half-time personal assistant who helps, you know, get me onto podcasts and schedule things and helps me, you know, be an organized human being. I also have a lot of people who do kind of contract work. So composers, music. I have like two people who sort of regularly will be writing and recording music for my videos. And I also use a lot of stock music. I will pay voice actors to read voiceover for some things. In my last video, actually, for the first time, I had a contractor to do visual effects. But a shocking amount of it, I say, well, I'm not shocked, but a lot of people I tell about are shocked. I just do it myself. I write the video. I do the research. A lot of times it's me moving the lights and camera around before I sit down to film. I'm alone. I'm editing the video by myself. It's kind of madness, actually. Most people who are at the level I'm at will hire an editor and hire other people to do these things. I'm not quite sure why I weirdly insist on doing it all myself still. I think it's hard to let go of control of your own project when you're used to doing it all yourself. But I think probably in the future, it's a little bit unsustainable that I'm doing all of this because, like I said, I have no life apart from this a lot of the time.
You mentioned that you were a trans woman and you have had the experience of transitioning in the public eye. You started making videos before you transitioned.
Yes.
You've talked about this a bit, about the ways cis folks, trans folks, anyone who is in front of a camera is going to develop, I speak from personal experience, like, all sorts of insanity about how you look. And I'm saying this with a lot of privilege in my sort of personal subjective bearing and also as someone who had a not intense relationship to how I appeared to the world or any kind of feelings that those didn't match how I felt inside. And so I could just imagine that, like, you know, that's got to be really magnified for putting yourself in front of a camera all the time.
Yes, you're imagining correctly. It is nightmarish. I mean, honestly, like, it's for a lot of trans women, like, how you look is often like the determining factor between, are you socially legible? Are you able to function in a given social space? Are you even allowed in to some certain spaces like bathrooms and things? It's like, so how you look is of extreme importance. You know, it's like the difference between being seen as a functioning member of society and some kind of, I don't know, liminal, like,
threat,
you know, freak or threat or yeah, threat. Right, yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that obviously is something that has been, you know, because I'm at a point in my transition now where, like, it's offline. This does not create a problem for me. Like, I shouldn't say it never creates a problem for me because, like, you know, I'm vaccinated now. So I went out to a club 2 weeks ago. You know, a man will just grope you if you're a woman. And so at a club and, like, you know, there's a kind of fear that comes with, okay, what happens when the man who basically assaults you, like, finds anatomy he wasn't expecting? Like,
right.
So, okay, that stuff is still a concern offline. But online, I mean, God, like, the microscopic analysis of every single physical feature that you have, assessing, you know, whether it's passable or whether you look male or female, it's hard not to go insane.
Yeah, and I think that, you had a great video essay about this, about beauty and about like sort of wrestling through all these questions and the ways and how it's bound up in identity, in personhood, in transness all together. And I just found it really brilliant and sort of got at this stuff in ways I hadn't thought about before.
Thank you.
Well, but partly because also, like, what I like about the videos, you're like, there's such an industry of like so much of, it's funny, so much of what's new is just old, right? So like when you go to the like recommended for you part of social media, right? Or things that have like tons of subscribers. And again, I'm generationally like out of touch with this, but it's all like, oh, these are like conventionally attractive women doing like conventionally suggestive dances. Like, it's like, oh, this is like the new frontier of media. And it's like, right, well, this is just what's been going on forever.
It's the same exact thing. Yeah, there's what was once called selfie feminism has turned out to be a disappointment in my view. It turns out that when you give women the camera, I mean, in some ways it improves things, but also in some ways things are not as different as one might have hoped. And I think that, it's tough. You know, it is a question that you ask yourself as a woman who's in media or your face is on camera all the time, like, at what point am I going to hit my expiration date? Well, I am pretty determined to resist that. I think that, I don't know, do men worry about their expiration date? Man, or maybe they do, but I don't think it's to the same extent. And I'm determined not to allow myself to be forced off for that reason. I think that, you know, there's more to my videos than looking at me. And my hope is that people, you know, I don't think that's the only reason people are watching.
Well, the expiration date, I mean, I totally hear that, but I also feel like if I were in your, how old are you, Natalie?
I'm 32.
So to me, the scarier thing from an expiration date is just like, you know, there's going to be like, you know, in 3 years, it's going to be like all the kids are into like this new app that's like a brain chip and like, I remember, again, I remember when I was on the cutting edge of media and like blogging, and now I have to read New York Times articles about what, you know, people are
what
doing
TikTok
on
is.
TikTok.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I'm and even there too. I'm like, I'm not I'm even sure, on TikTok. Like, I'm like losing it. Yeah.
It all moves so quickly. And I wonder how quickly the waters are rushing around you.
Yeah. Well, that's a question I ask myself frequently. I do think I need to get on TikTok, but I don't use it. You know, my judgment is that YouTube is going to be here for the foreseeable future. I don't claim to be able to foresee very far into the future. So by foreseeable future, I mean 3 years, let's say. So, you know, I think that it's going to be around for that long. But yeah, I do think it is the height of hubris to imagine that the current technology and this current state of social media, oh, that's just what the reality is going to be for the next 50 years. Like, that seems highly unlikely if you compare us to where we were 50 years ago. So I do think for anyone to have long-term career success that spans decades in this industry, meaning media, you have to keep in mind that you need to be agile. You need to be spotting the next trend. And oh, I know it's
exhausting.
Weird, yeah, it's like, it is exhausting, but you have to do it. There's this weird new app that kids are using. God, do we really have to learn this? Yes, you do. You have to learn it. Find a 20-year-old, buy them lunch, and have them show you how to do it.
Yeah, my wife's, she has a legal podcast called Strict Scrutiny, which is fantastic, which I recommend. And one of her co-hosts has just started doing, like, did that and just started doing, like, legal TikToks. And they've been hugely successful.
That's cool.
I was like, wow, that's awesome. Yeah, it was exactly just like, all right, I'm going to figure this out. I think she may have, like, recruited a young to give her, like, a tutorial.
Yeah, it's good to get a youth spy. I think it's from 1984.
Right? Youth spy. You are engaged in this different kind of discourse, right? These long-form videos. Mm-hmm. And you talk about trying to kind of bring people in. Like, I wonder if you must have interactions with your viewers and your patrons, surely. And I wonder if, like, you hear from people that you changed the mind of, or who got into politics through you, or that you introduced into a different worldview.
Yeah, I've heard from many people like that in the last few years. There's sort of been different eras, I guess, of my channel, but a lot of people who watch my channel have reached out and told me that my videos in some way helped them not to fall into the far right kind of pipeline, because often they'll say, like, oh, I was watching all these Ben Shapiro videos and I was really annoyed at feminists and but your videos I didn't feel judged by. And it opened my eyes and gave me this perspective that sort of took some of the appeal out of Ben Shapiro. That to me feels good. Taking the appeal out of Ben Shapiro. Yes. That's good. If I did that for one person, that's a day's work.
we started by, you were saying that, you know, fascism always sort of looms in the background.
Yeah.
And you said an interesting thing, which is that it felt less intense in some ways than 2015. That 2015 felt like a kind of peak of a certain kind of political formation online. And maybe it's less that way now. And I wonder, with this sort of rise of this kind of like counter woke, you know, internet community, which to me feels very much like the new atheists, like very, very yeah. similar, in some ways is sometimes the same people. And
literally, yeah.
Yeah, like the same impulses, like what you make of that and whether that feels different or similar to some of the things you've seen happen before in these internet spaces.
Well, I guess the reason to me that 2016, 2015 were scarier than now is that back then I felt like I was one of very few people who were noticing. Gamergate was written about, but when the alt-right was gaining traction on YouTube and on social media, there was an early period where this was not being taken seriously at all, like before Trump was elected. And that I can remember being in some ways the scariest. Nazi adjacent ideology was like gaining incredible traction. And that to me was like Ionesco's play Rhinoceros, where all the, you know, it's a metaphor for the coming of fascism. Everyone around you is turning into a rhino. It felt like that. Hmm. And that's when I kind of started making these videos against that trend. But then, you know, obviously the Trump era in some ways got less scary for me because I felt less alone. It's like, oh, everyone else is now paying attention too.
Right.
So it's like, okay, I'm not crazy and I'm not alone. And now I would say that, you know, one major change, and this actually kind of affects the way I work and think, is that when I started doing my YouTube videos, leftist YouTube was not really a thing. There was kind of feminist YouTube, which was mostly vloggers who would talk about feminist issues and then get ruthlessly dunked on by these skeptic people. But there wasn't an economy of leftist video essays in the way that there is now. There's just hundreds of these creators who are making left-tube videos. Hmm. And that has kind of changed me. For one thing, I don't have the sense that I used to have that I'm surrounded by the encroaching victory of the far right. I have instead the sense that I'm surrounded by leftists feuding with each other.
Right.
It changes the kind of topic that you're prone to discuss.
Yeah. And those internecine battles can be they can take it out of you even more in some ways.
They can.
It cuts so much more deeply when you're critiqued by a comrade than a foe.
In some ways, it was more fun in 2017 when the people sending you death threats were Nazis, because there's a sense of righteous victimhood that comes with that. Whereas now, when it's just, I don't know, an angry 20-year-old anarchist harassing me, it's like, I don't know, it just doesn't have the same thrill to it.
But I also wonder, too, if we're in a moment now where, like, what was a kind of internet subculture and vanguard is incredibly mainstream now. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yes. No, I think that's right. Yeah.
The insurrection January 6th was like basically a normie insurrection. It was like,
yes, a normie insurrection. Yeah.
It was not online edgelords.
This was not 8chan. Yeah.
No, it was not 8chan. Mm-hmm. It was like people with, you know, people with boats and mortgages.
People with boats. Yeah. 100%.
Who stormed the Capitol. And it's like, that's, but that is now like
uprising.
Yeah. And like, exactly. Yeah. And like, that is now what was, you know, on the edges and in these like forums is now like part and parcel of like a kind of like mainstream American political faction formation tendency that is, I think, an existential threat to American democracy, but is also like,
yes,
takes up so much space in daylight that it's not this, you know, it's not this creepy thing at the edges anymore.
I agree with that. Yeah. And in some sense, I feel like, it is so mainstream that, like, I feel like as a YouTuber, it's not quite my domain in the way that it used to be. Maybe that's what I'm feeling, right? As this,
right,
as this just becomes what conservatism in America is. It's like, well, you know, this is, everyone's already talking about this. So I have to find something that,
right,
because I'm always looking, you know, what can I do that other people aren't doing, right? Because I sort of feel other people are working on this. Of course, who knows how to solve this problem? It is, as you say, like, it's a threat to democracy. It's in some ways an almost, would have been an unimaginably awful outcome like 8 years ago that this is where we would be. But yeah, it's kind of out of my league now.
Natalie Wynn goes by ContraPoints on YouTube. You can find her there. You can find her on Patreon as well. I really, really suggest if after you listen to this podcast, if you haven't seen any of her work or heard any of her work, you should head over to her YouTube page and watch a bunch. Natalie, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Once again, great thanks to Natalie Wynn. You can check her out at ContraPoints, ContraPoints, ContraPoints on YouTube. If you search for her, you'll find her videos. Start with any of them. You can start with the famous incel one. The one on beauty is fantastic. And I'm looking forward to the new super mega opus that she's working on now. Tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. We really do love to hear your feedback, so send it along. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.